Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to the A24 Project here on the Nerd Party Network. Every 2 weeks, we look at two films from the A24 filmography, and in between, we try and bring you interviews with the talent involved in bringing these films to the big screen. In this episode, I'm joined by the writer-director of Low Tide, Kevin McMullen. For those not familiar with Low Tide, follows Alan, Red and Smitty, who spend high summer on the Jersey Shore, roving the boardwalk and getting into trouble. But the discovery of a good old-fashioned treasure sets the friends on an escalating course of suspicion and violence. Thanks so much to Kevin for joining us to discuss the making of this film, and I hope you too enjoy the interview. I'd love to know, what kind of inspired you to kind of your journey towards a career within the creative industry?
Well, when I was a kid, I got a camera in my hands when I was 13 years old. Previous to that, I drew a lot, and my parents, I was good at school, and they wanted me to be an architect. I think they kind of pushed that on me, just because any waking moment I had, I would draw. And my older brother, he was a skateboarder, and he would always be hanging on the street with his friends. And they got a camera, and they needed someone to film all their epic moves, you know. And this is right around the time when nonlinear editing software just started to become embedded, you know, prepackaged with the family computers. And so it was kind of a combination of kind of creating a world that I loved to do when I was drawing, and then interacting with folks, like hanging out with my older brother and his friends. And I was pretty shy, so it was a way for me to reach out to folks, you know, kids in school, and kind of organize a shoot. And I just became addicted really, really fast. So from the time I was 13 on, just started making a lot of backyard movies, like way too many to count. And it's funny now that it's a career, because there was no real choice along the way. There was no day where I kind of decided to pursue it. It was just something I kind of did for so much of my life that I just never really stopped. I've been very fortunate.
Were there any sort of films, commercials, any kind of art that inspired you when you were younger that you really looked up to?
Oh, yeah. So when I was a kid, I was 10 years old, and I got two VHS tapes for Christmas. One was Good Will Hunting, and the other was Apollo 13. And I wore those movies out. I don't know if you're old enough to remember VHS tapes, but there would become a point when you would watch it too much and the sound and the color would fade. So that happened to me in those two movies. I think as I got a little bit older, I started paying attention to music videos and commercials. And I was a big fan of like Mark Romanek and Spike Jones, Mark Webb. And I was lucky that in middle school and high school, I grew up with the internet. And so you could start to find all these videos online. And rewatch them like crazy. And as I got a little bit older, I started going back and checking out a lot of John Huston films, and Hitchcock and Spielberg, and I was a big weekend warrior at Blockbuster. You know, I would just kind of pile up new releases, anything that said Miramax, anything that said Sundance, and then a bunch of the classics.
I'm very flattered that you think I might be too old to too young to remember VHS tape. I remember it all too well. I think I had a slightly different reaction to Apollo 13 than you. I remember my dad took me to see it after school one day, and my reaction coming out of the cinema was, I really want to be an astronaut, which I might not have thought was kind of the thing to take away from that film. I think you'd want to stay far away from space as possible after that.
Yeah, right. And I think my earliest movie memory actually is Jurassic Park. So I think the first film came out in 93, so I would have been 5 years old, and my parents took us to the film, and I think I, like, at some point, I guess it was like hyperventilating, or they thought I was scared, you know, and so my father was in charge of like bringing me out to the lobby and saying like, just calm down a minute, let me know when you want to go back in, or if you want to go back in, and I was so confused as to why he even took me out of the theater, you know, so we went back in right away. But that movie memory always kind of stuck with me too. I guess it was very easy as a child, especially, to kind of jump into another world for a couple hours.
We must be around the same age. I'm 32, 33 in March. And I remembered we discussed this actually today at work. What was the first film that you remember going to see? And one of mine was Jurassic Park. So yeah, it's we definitely seem to be birds of a feather here.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's child of Spielberg. You know, E.T. was like another big staple on VHS as a kid. And then I remember when one of the anniversary editions came out on DVD as I got a little bit older. And I don't know if you remember this, but they ended up going back in and digitally enhancing a bunch of the puppet work. And I was furious.
Didn't they, like, remove the guns from the police officers and replace them by walkie-talkies?
Yeah. Don't worry. I still have my really old VHS copy, so I can go back and see the original anytime. I was more shocked at what they did to the puppetry, which I think is like beautiful. I love. I ended up making a short film years later with a dinosaur puppet, and I think that no matter how good CGI gets, I always walk away from a movie kind of seeing or saying, you know, it's good CGI instead of. Maybe kind of losing myself in it, where those older films that deal with that live-action puppetry tend to have pulled it off, I guess, in a cleaner way.
You kind of talked about sort of like your love and kind of journey towards the creative industry just kind of kept rolling and rolling. How did you sort of break into the industry? When was the moment you realized, oh, I think I've made it inside?
I still don't feel like that, to be perfectly honest. I think when I was in, I ended up going to Columbia University for film school, and while I was there, I made a bunch of short films, and you know, you send them out to film festivals, and you get some play, and once in a while, you might be in a position where, like, someone reached out to see if you were open to doing any kind of commercials or branded content, and I think about the age of like 24, 25 is when I was actually starting to make a living doing something with a camera, you know, making these commercials, and that was a pretty phenomenal realization. I remember we went home for Christmas one year, and I had done this it's a TV spot for Crest toothpaste, and it was playing while my family was like opening up Christmas presents on Christmas morning, and that was kind of a moment where I was like, oh, okay, this something I'm making is actually like getting airplay, which was incredible, and I took that money and promptly spent it on a couple months of just focusing on my writing, you know, and I figured, oh, if I can kind of do this, if I can book a couple commercials and then spend my time writing movies and trying to hustle and get those made, then I guess that's kind of what I would define as a success or breaking in.
Is there any sort of like commercials that are out there that people might not be aware that you have worked on, where, you know, people maybe bring up or maybe have a special sweet spot for people that they don't realize you were the one behind?
Well, you know, it's funny. One time I was, there was a buddy of mine who was pulling together a bunch of references. He was doing what's called a rip-o-matic, which is when you take movies and commercials and you condense them into like a 2-minute trailer for something you're doing. And I remember seeing there was a reference that he pulled that was one of my older commercials. So that was funny. So that happens once in a while when the world gets smaller and when you realize that, like, you meet another filmmaker and you guys have a mutual friend who's a producer or an editor. And that's always my favorite. When you realize the world's small.
When did sort of Low Tide start to form in your mind? Was it always something that was destined to be a feature, or did it have kind of maybe smaller ambitions when it first came to mind?
When it first came to mind, I wanted to make a feature, and I decided that I was kind of burnt out doing commercials one year, and I had I did the math. I had enough money that I could afford rent and food for the rest of the year, and I knew that that was a very lucky position to be in. And so I was going to sit down, and I said I will come away writing a movie. I don't know if it's going to be good or not, but it was something that I wanted to be able to produce. And so to me, I just kind of I went back to where I grew up, which is a really inherently cinematic area of New Jersey. I grew up with forests and water, so both things I felt like it would be fun to capture in a movie. And I just started writing from this place that I knew, and that's really kind of the origin of it. And I didn't know when I finished the script if it would get any traction whatsoever. But in film school, I'd been an intern at a couple different production companies. And when you intern there, you know, besides getting coffee and answering phone calls, they give you a lot of scripts that come in, which is a really great education and well worth the free internship, because you get to interact with the scripts that are coming in from writers who have representation. And usually you have to read like two or three or four a day, and you write up coverage, which is basically a summary of what you read and whether or not you liked it and if it has prospects for that specific company. And it gave me a sense of when a script is finished, how it actually interacts with the world and what pierces through this very oversaturated world. And I found that whenever a filmmaker presented a script alongside a lookbook, which is just a PDF of a bunch of images and maybe kind of a small production plan of how they want to execute the project, or a trailer, whether or not they shot it themselves or they pulled references from other movies like the Rip Matic I mentioned earlier, or they shot a short film. I would always kind of give those filmmakers the benefit of the doubt when I was reading incoming scripts. And I felt like if I did that, then that there was a good shot that folks out there who were doing the same job that I had been doing would maybe give my movie the benefit of the doubt if I had some kind of supplementary material. So I put together a lookbook, and I took some savings, and I went out and I shot a 2 or 3 day trailer, and I just found some local kids in the town that I grew up in that I wanted to show off. These kids who were at a burrito stand, and one kid who was at a train station, I just asked if they wanted to make, you know, $50 a day and kind of hang out, and we would just film this trailer, music video style. So no audio capture. It was myself, my cinematographer, a gaffer friend, and a costume production designer friend, and we all fit in a 15-pass vehicle, equipment, and cast, and we went around using natural light to all these locations that I had written the movie specifically for, like the marine welding yard and this old harbor and the really touristy beach and boardwalk. And I just kind of, I cobbled together this montage that was 40 seconds long, and I sent the script and that little teaser and a lookbook to the one contact I had, which was a friend of a friend of a friend, who was a manager in Hollywood. And he really got on board with what I was trying to execute. And so he sent it out to a few of his friends at production companies, and then the whole thing kind of snowballed from there.
Was the film always going to be set in around sort of the 80s and 90s? Was that built into the script from the start, or did that kind of evolve through time?
I think I wrote without references to cell phones. And so I think it's funny when you remove computers and cell phones, it just takes on this sense of early 90s or late 80s. I love that period, pretty much just having grown up in it. So the design, the costumes, and the production design. So I kind of ran full tilt toward that. And I like that it's kind of maybe an amalgamation of some of those years. We didn't have the budget to specify a precise year, but nor did I want to. I just like this idea of of saying, you know, it's in the recent past. And that felt akin to how I grew up, where cell phones were still a real novelty, as were computers. And it was just, what it did was it forced the characters into face-to-face confrontation, you know, and I think that's always a lot more fun to watch on screens than characters texting back and forth.
When you started to write and form this film, was it always your intention that you would direct it, or did you think, maybe I'm just going to sell the script and someone else will bring Low Tide to life? Did you always have it in mind that it was going to be you in the director's chair?
Yeah, no, I wrote it to direct it, and a big reason why I wrote it for the those towns that I grew up in was because I figured that worst comes to worst, I could find some non-actor local kids and shoot it one summer for a very low budget, and we were lucky enough to kind of pick up some momentum and to get a little more money, although the budget wasn't so great, but it was enough that allowed some more substantial or more established Hollywood, young Hollywood actors to kind of hop on board the project. But yeah, the intention was always write something for myself to direct.
How long was the sort of the pre-production process from script to through to funding to first day on set?
It was, fall 2015 when I sat down, I started to write, and I kind of got an outline in a good place, and then I was kind of underwater with the commercials for a few months, so I picked it up to actually flesh out the outline and write it in spring 2016, and that's when the first draft came together. Summer 2016, I invested in that little teaser shoot and created the lookbook, so that October 2016, the script, the lookbook, the teaser were all sent out to a few contacts, and then those contacts started sending out to more people. And I went out to Los Angeles, and I met with a couple of production companies and a couple of agencies that were interested at that time. And by February 2017, I got a phone call that we were fully financed. And by summer 2017, July, we were rolling cameras. So only in retrospect am I learning just how fast that was, and how lucky we were to kind of get the project up on its feet that fast. But I think some of the things that helped were firstly that it was written to feature teen characters. It seems like there's a healthy audience for narratives that have teenage protagonists, and two, that the budget we were seeking was very low. And I think if we were either seeking older actors or more money, then the project might never have happened, or definitely would have been delayed. But again, I think keeping the characters young and keeping the budget very low, we were able to get that financing faster.
You touched on the financing there. I had to double check this when I was doing a bit of research the other day, that you made this film amazingly for $1 million. And I was like, I couldn't believe that. I thought maybe it's a typo, maybe there's a zero missing from that. What were the benefits and the limitations of this type of budget? Because I was shocked when I thought of the cast, the look of this film. Yeah. I didn't see a $1 million film on there. I genuinely was shocked there. And I even, like, going into this interview, I was like, yeah, I think it's definitely $1 million the way you're talking there. What were kind of the benefits of that?
Well, actually, the budget was less. It was $830,000. So every penny kind of had a count. And I think that growing up, you know, where we shot it, I knew what time of day was best to film in certain spots. You know, and I think you achieve a higher production value for far less if you have that kind of intimate knowledge of where you're shooting. Rather than get like a cherry picker and a bunch of lights and then have to get more grips and more food to feed those grips, if we just showed up at the harbor from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m., we would get that nice backlight, you know, and, you know, essentially the production value would skyrocket. just because we timed it correctly. So there was a lot of that reverse engineering, the look I wanted to, and with the AD and the cinematographer, and just making sure we kind of got to the locations or were able to film a certain direction when we wanted to. And then I think we were just so lucky to get the cast that we did, especially when we did. I think it was before a lot of the cast members are better known now, just a couple of years later after we cast it. But it was very obvious that all these young actors were going on to have pretty big careers, and I was lucky to catch them in this transition where they were still open to doing very low budget films for essentially scale, whatever the minimum union required pay was.
What was the casting process like for this film? As you say, you seem to really hit the jackpot with these casts, which sometimes just can, you know, when I sort of looked at their IMDb's after watching the film, I was like, I'm sure I recognised that from there and there and there. It's you must have a great eye for casting to get them at such a time of their career.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's a good eye or it's obvious, I think, to anyone who watches these kids, which is why they're all kind of being cast in other TV shows and movies right now. But the first cast member to get on board was Jaden Martell. I got a call from his agency that he wanted to play Peter, which was, in my mind, the hardest role to cast, as the younger brother. And he's got the largest arc, and he needed an actor who was very intelligent. I had seen him in a movie called St. Vincent with Bill Murray. That was his very first movie. And then he went on to star opposite Michael Shannon in a great Jeff Nichols film called Midnight Special. And so I Skyped Jaden, and he's preternaturally talented. He's wise beyond his years. And I knew he would bring a lot of emotion to that role. And moving forward, we had a large runway. I think this was in spring 2017, and a lot of casting decisions happened the weeks leading up to prep. But I was lucky that we had a few months, and I knew that Jaden was going to play Peter. So from then on, when I would work with our casting director, Susan Shotmaker and Lois Drapkin out of New York City, I was in this great position where any actor who's coming in for a read in person or sending me a tape, I could kind of cast them in my head in context of Jaden. And, there's like so many great young actors out there, and it really was, are they right for this, or could they play opposite Jaden, or how would they complement, what would that contrast look like? And so I think next up was Kian Johnson, who played Alan, and I loved his read. He sent a self-tape in, and he was super confident, and he was playing the role with this like sense of impulsivity, and I loved it. I thought that version of Alan with Jaden's version of Peter would make this really interesting dynamic that was present in the script unfold really nicely on camera, which was kind of a role reversal in terms of older and younger brother dynamics. And then next I saw Alex Neustetter, who played Red, and I was getting a lot of submissions in for Red, and I picked kind of this monologue-y section of the script for actors to audition with, and most every actor that walked in kind of it was an intimidating speech, and a lot of them kind of went forward in that direction. And Alex did something very interesting, which was he played it opposite, a very silent, very quiet, and somehow that was way more intimidating. And I thought that not only is this guy like a really smart actor and extremely nice person, he could play this role, I think, in a really dark way that I don't know. I just thought it was super interesting. And then we were like, we were about like 5 minutes from calling the casting. I remember I got a call from the casting director that I had to see this kid named Daniel Salgadri. And they sent me first a tape that he had submitted for a TV show. It was a different project, but it was like a minute and a half long video. And I remember I laughed that loud watching it, and then I teared up because he was giving this monologue that was the first funny and then extremely sad. And I thought, wow, this kid can kind of do anything. And I met with him, and he's such a smart young man. And I felt we were both aligned on this idea that the character of Smitty that Danielle plays should really be Machiavellian. And you needed this actor who could really give this really powerful turn. Like at first, you would believe that he's kind of the runt of the group, you know, a bit of the comic relief, but you need someone who could also pull off this more sinister side. And then there's Christine Froseth. She came in for Reed. I believe this might have been chronologically her first movie. I know she was in a music video and she was modeling beforehand. There have been other movies and TV shows that she's in that have come out sooner. But that might have been her first movie, which was pretty cool. But again, it's so obvious when she walked in the room. She had this kind of archetypal innocence that reminded me a lot of Sybil Shepherd from The Last Picture Show, which is kind of how I had always envisioned Mary, the character that she plays. And then last of the lead cast was Shea Whigham, who he found this project really alone. When I was going and meeting with a couple of different agencies, someone knew Shea, and they asked if if I'd be interested in and I have been a massive fan since a David Gordon Green film called All the Real Girls, where Shea's character is wearing braces and a fanny pack, and I used to quote him in college. I love that movie so much. So I had the opportunity to sit with him for breakfast, and we really bonded over this idea that his character, Sergeant Kent, is the father figure and kind of the only adult, or one of the only adults in the entire movie. It kind of speaks with a little more reason and caution and perspective. And Shea came on set, and he's just like the nicest guy, excellent actor, always prepared, really collaborative. And we were just, again, we were phenomenally fortunate to land the cast that we did.
Did your kind of commercial and short background really help going in to making a feature? What kind of skills were really transferable for a process like this?
Well, yes, the shorts and the commercials. I mean, set is not much different day to day. I mean, you have a camera and you have a lens and you have some lights and a crew, and there's a list of things you have to accomplish. I think with a feature, you're telling such a giant story, right? With a commercial, you show up and you're making a 30-second spot, and in that one day, you're going to capture that entire 30-second spot, so it's easier to hold the entire arc in your head. Whereas with a feature film, you're shooting out of order, and we were lucky enough to shoot 30 days, so those 30 days were over 6 weeks, and so you might film one scene on day one that's bookended by two scenes you're filming on the very last day of production a month and a half later. So you're trying to keep a tone, I think, consistent. And past that, you're trying to manage the cast and crew. And, you know, I was pretty diligent about having a lot of storyboards on set. But you realize that when push comes to shove and the sun's going down, a lot of that goes out the window, and you kind of have to figure it out on the spot. And more than that, one of the great lessons of this project was considering on day 22 the endurance factor and the fatigue factor of cast and crew. And even though you might have two more shots planned for that day, you can sense that everyone's a little tired, and tomorrow's another big day. And it's easier to send everyone home a little early and to kind of rest up for the next day, instead of kind of waste overtime on getting those two shots that were incidental to begin with.
I think one of these things that I really was struck with by Low Tide was how it seems to subvert the expectations going in. I think maybe some people go in and think, oh, this is like, they read the description, go, oh, this is kind of a Goonies film for maybe the indie generation. And it really kind of plays with the expectations going in, which is always kind of rewarding. Was that sort of your kind of ambition going in, or is that something that's kind of come around maybe kind of in the marketing afterwards?
No, when I put together the original lookbook, we talked about how it's like we're going to subvert the Amblin tone. I spoke a lot about The Outsiders and Rumblefish and The Goonies, but also Last Picture Show and Rian Johnson's Brick, and I wanted to make something that. It felt familiar, but slowly started to descend into something darker, and it was a kind of a fine balance in the edit room to kind of mirror the tone that I think was present in the script. But yeah, that was always the intention, something that subverted that kind of that Amblin. So by the act turn, the Goonies is this great story. Is this disparate group of kids, and they're on this mission together to find gold, which they do in the third act, and they kind of save the day, and they come together, and I think our story differs because at the end of the first act, these kids have found this very valuable thing, and all of a sudden they start deteriorating from the inside out, and that's something I always wanted to explore when I sat down and started writing it. I think that was always more interesting, the sides of teens that maybe you don't see, but certainly exist, that kids can be just as mean, you know, just as greedy as adults.
I think it's really good at getting into sort of the consequences that children can kind of get themselves into. I think we were talking about it when we watched it. It was like, you know, when you're younger, you think you're untouchable. You know, it's just like the movies. You know, you're never going to get in trouble from the police. You always manage to skip and hop away in the time. And I think this film is really good at showing people aren't untouchable. And it really kind of delves into the consequences of sort of youth behavior sometimes.
Yeah, and it's funny. When I wrote it, I didn't have a title for a little while. So when I would send to my friends for notes, I would always refer to it as the pirate movie, which is funny because I don't think it's come up a lot in conversations about the film. But to me, it was always the origin story of pirates. You know, they're modern day, but there's still a lot of that imagery. Whether it's there's some spoilers, but there's enough imagery, marine imagery, to make the metaphor compelling, I think.
One of my favourite films of the year, I don't know if you've seen this one, Kevin, is a British film called Bait. Are you familiar with it?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
Well, I'll send you a link to this one. So it's both it and Low Tide would make an incredible kind of double feature, because both of them focus on sort of this kind of class warfare between those who live in these sorts of popular holiday towns and those rich and affluent visitors that kind of come in seasonally.
Sure.
What inspired you to explore this theme, and why do you think things like that kind of class warfare seems to be kind of coming into more and more films recently?
Well, I can only guess at why that theme might be present in more films, but I think the economic contrast is a good dramatic starting point, you know, and I think personally my connection to that was where I grew up in Monmouth County, New Jersey. There's a town called Point Pleasant Beach. That was my first, summer jobs. Like I was, they have a beach and a boardwalk, and on the boardwalk, if you want to play some of the games like spin the wheels, or you want to shoot water guns, I was like this 14-year-old kid who would hand you the teddy bear, you know, if you want. And then I graduated to work in the arcade the next couple of years, and then as a waiter when I got a little bit older. I had a different perspective, I think, on that tourist industry than maybe someone who just goes to vacation there, because that's where I was living and working, and you see from the other side. And what I noticed is a lot of the locals, there would be a natural resentment toward for the folks who would come in. But it was interesting because simultaneously there was this resentment, but also this economic dependence. You know, like without those out-of-towners coming in for those 2 or 3 months of the year, that those towns don't survive. So I thought that was a really interesting juxtaposition because, you know, at the same time that you don't want them there, you need them. That was always present, kind of taking it from the local perspective and through the eyes of these teams.
One thing I really enjoyed about this was sort of the location of sort of Jersey Shore. You know, for most people, they'll probably think of shows like The Sopranos and that reality TV show that come to mind. Did you want to showcase this location in a very different light? And what were sort of some of the challenges and benefits of shooting a low-budget film within Jersey City?
It's interesting. So we shot the film mostly in Point Pleasant Beach, New Jersey. That was kind of our hero location, and then all around Monmouth and Ocean County. So it's right in the center of the state by the coast. And I don't know if it was it wasn't an intention to show a different side of it. It was trying to be a little more faithful to that town that I grew up in and my perspective of it. The Jersey Shore TV show is a funny comp only because we. It is kind of the same location, I guess, but the people are different. And in my experience, it was always, growing up was a lot more like closer to a Bruce Springsteen song than it was to the Jersey Shore TV show, if that makes sense.
So I really enjoyed what almost felt like sort of the teenage mafia side to this film. Was it a challenge to get it as believable as it was and thinking like, will the audience buy into this or will they think of it as, oh, it's just young kids kind of playing kind of mafia gangsters?
I mean, that's always a fear, but I think the film takes the kids seriously, and I think the stakes are high, and I think it's true emotionally, just because at that age, irregardless of whether or not what you're going through is a big deal, it feels like it, you know, I wanted to honor that sentiment, and I think taking it from the kids' point of view and not having a lot of adults in the picture maintains the stakes, the internal stakes for our lead characters. And I think as long as they believe it, then the audience will too.
I won't spoil it, but at the climax of the film, you feel like this story could continue. And it seems to have kind of created a bit of a buzz where audience members can discuss like what they think comes next. Even though I doubt that you've got a sequel and, you know, ever going to happen, do you have one in your head that you would love to do, like maybe a Low Tide 2? And what are some of the best What Happened Next ideas you might have heard from audience members?
Well, there's no sequel. There won't be a sequel. But, I have a very clear idea of where the characters go. I think when I was actually sitting down to write it, The end sequence, the very final 2 minutes of the film, that was the generative image for the entire movie. So when I sat down, with that sequence, and there was a large time when for a few weeks of writing, I went forward from that sequence as if that was the starting point of a movie, and then I realized that was actually the ending point of a more interesting film, It was important to me that's where it ended, and to kind of work backwards to see how characters could end up there. And there's a bit of a morality play, you know. And as I said before, is this kind of weird origin story of a modern day pirate. I think that's pretty apt descriptive. But I wouldn't want to. I've heard a few theories, maybe what happens next. But I'd prefer not to say what happened in my head, just because it's fun to hear the audience kind of interact and to guess. And I think that when you're watching a movie, then you know it's not necessarily mine anymore, and someone else's theory could be just as valid.
What was sort of the post-production stage like kind of for this film once you'd kind of completed it, to getting it ready for sort of the festival circuit and for eventually distribution?
Yeah, the post was pretty rushed, I would say. I saw an assembly cut in late September of 2017, and we had some contractual obligations with the financier that made us we had to submit to certain festivals pretty soon after, you know, which I think is standard practice in the industry, where you're submitting rough cuts and assembly cuts. And that was different than say, like a short film, because a short film, I'm usually self-financing those. And so I could sit down, I could take as long as I want to kind of get it right and to workshop it. And there were certain expectations contractually that we had to fulfill. So I saw a rough cut, an assembly cut in last week of September 2017. And then by January 31st, it was pencils down on the actual cut. And from then on out, I had 6 weeks to do a color, sound design, visual effects, and to score it. We had a great post team. Eddie Nice was the editor, and we would sit in this tiny closet in Brooklyn together, and we would each had a computer, and we would just edit all day, at least 6 days a week, sometimes seven. Just to kind of to turn it around as fast as we needed to, and then I was very lucky to get an excellent sound designer named Colin Alexander on board, and great musicians Will Brook and the Blair brothers, Will Blair and Brooke Blair. They are really, really amazing. I knew their work from a filmmaker named Jeremy Saulnier, who did Blue Ruin and Green Room. And when their names came up, I thought I knew their music, and I wanted something a lot more melodic than what Jeremy prefers in those films. But when I listened to their wider portfolio, I realized that they're so accomplished in so many different genres, and that they could do anything. And I was confused as to why they were even willing to do this film, because again, we had minimal resources, but I think in talking to them, at least the goal was they kind of wanted to expand their portfolio a bit and kind of do something a little more classical and rich and melodic and play with some different instruments. So I was lucky again to kind of catch them at a time in their career where they were willing to kind of backtrack and work for nothing. They knocked it out of the park.
What were the early reactions like when it starts touring the festivals? When did you realize quite early on that you had something that was really resonating with audiences, or did it kind of catch you by surprise how much kind of critical acclaim it was getting?
Well, we only had a one rough cut screening, you know, a few weeks before we had it handed in. So I was not really used to seeing with an audience until the premiere at Tribeca in 2019, and that was extremely nerve-wracking, but really, really fun. You know, I went to school here in New York City, and I grew up in New Jersey, so it was great to see so many family and friends come out for the show, and that was really fun, because it was nice to kind of sit back in the middle of the sold-out theater and to kind of hear that the jokes were landing, you know, which was important, just because to me, the tone is not so dour, you know. It is playful, and there are definitely parts where I'm piercing attention purposely, and it was nice to hear that those were resonating with the audience. We were lucky that we got some great reviews, and then A24 came on board and wanted to put it in theaters, which was insane to me, and really. In retrospect, it's kind of a miracle that the movie got made at all, and I was just really lucky that we got the cast and the crew that we did, the distributor that we did, and it's surreal that people are actually finding it and starting to watch it now that it's on Amazon Prime for free. And I think this is right around the time when people are starting to really engage with it. And it's fun. I really do hope the audience dig it.
At what point does someone like A24 get involved, and what was their pitch to you? Because imagine you have a few different people kind of going, hey, we'd love to take Low Tide, this is our kind of offer. What was their pitch to you to take Low Tide into their filmography?
I met some folks at A24 based off of the script and that little teaser and lookbook I had put together, and so they were interested from that stage, as were a couple other distribution companies, and really early on in some conversations with some of the producers, we all felt like A24 is just this wonderful distributor with so many great films. And so to me it was a real honor, because whenever I see that logo I kind of perk up, very interested to see what's going on in their catalog, and so I think to kind of have that stamp was a real honor, you know, and it's a pretty cool club to be a part of.
What sort of are the kind of films in their filmography that kind of stand out for you? Is there some that are kind of personal favorites of yours?
Yeah, sure, yeah. Under the Skin might be one of my favorite movies of all time. I think that one really hit a primal nerve. The imagery, Jonathan Glazer is like a master. So that film is really big, and I love Robert Eggers' The Witch, and Good Time is an amazing film. So I think if you go down the list, it's kind of hard to find a bad one. But it's certainly this amazing list of movies, and it's kind of when I remember being a kid in Blockbuster. Browsing around, and I would see the Miramax logo, and I remember just picking up any movie that had that logo on it. That was kind of my first experience with a lot of foreign films, actually, just because that logo meant something for a few years there in the 90s. And I kind of feel that A24 maybe has that same influence right now, you know, where you see that logo, and even if the trailer is not appealing to you specifically, you know you're going to see something interesting, you know, and they have just their entire catalog is pretty stellar.
And what's kind of next for yourself? And that kind of Low Tide's been out for a few months now in America, and as you say, it's making the rounds as we were kind of recording this. It's kind of front page on the iTunes USA, you know, films of the kind of the year people can pick up. And, you know, Amazon Prime, so more and more people are going to find it, especially with these kind of Christmas breaks. What's kind of next for you, and, you know, what kind of impact do you sort of see Low Tide having over the coming months and years?
I was so happy just to make a movie. You know, it was like one of the first movies where I didn't have to pay for it myself. So it was pretty phenomenal just to kind of get a shot. I'm working on another script right now that we're hoping to shoot this summer, and so that one's a much different genre. It's going to be a different visual approach. It's a supernatural horror film about an old couple that find a baby on a farm, and so and then I just got a writing gig for a studio to write this monster movie. So it's a really surreal time right now, and it still feels like this giant transition from doing shorts and commercials to doing features. But I'm really looking forward to the future and to kind of play with to play inside a bunch of different genres and to kind of keep learning, you know, and keep working with great actors and new equipment and I think the wonderful thing about movies in general is that it's such a rich medium that there is always a lot more to learn, to try, and to play with, and you can kind of keep going forever.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Kevin. It's been a real pleasure. Sounds like we've got a lot to kind of look forward to in the coming months and years from you. So thank you so much, and I wish you all the best with all your future projects. Thanks again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.